Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on Hot Plate, eating on the go, breeding for success, freezer tips, and hangover cures. Hi, Joshna. How are you doing?
You know what? It's not a great one. This has been a really, really difficult week in the world. It's not even just here in Toronto or the country. But with racial tensions spilling over as intensely as they have been with our friends in the U.S., we're all feeling it. And it is heavy, man. It is heavy.
Yeah, these are really difficult times. I mean, I'm grateful that this is being spoken about and that
right.
through all of, because we're still all in isolation, we're still all dealing, you know, most
Seriously.
Of us with some very heavy stuff already, and the fact that everyone in the middle of this pandemic has taken the time to really acknowledge and start discussing this issue is a good thing. I agree with you. Just
it definitely needs to happen. This is a long overdue conversation for us. But holy smokes, what a pylon of things, right? A pylon meaning pile of things all together, right? On top of all of it. It's really mega. And I'm finding myself just having to take lots of deep breaths and force myself to slow down and just chill out a bit, right?
It's and you're not alone. But yeah, I'm also glad I have to say that these issues in the U.S., I think issues is a, it seems like a trite term.
Curious euphemism. Yeah.
Maybe these murders would be crises, more appropriate. Yeah. Have also highlighted the very real issues that are happening here in Canada. Yeah. And I'm hoping that conversation continues. But yeah, shout out to Black Lives Matter and the great work that they're doing during this time. And
never been more important, I think, right?
Yeah.
And to have them as that strong voice is super important.
Yeah.
All right. So I've been thinking about, I have actually been thinking about drive-through restaurants. I'm a child of the suburbs.
Right.
I grew up born in the suburbs, and the drive-through was a very regular part of my life for many years. And then I've noticed that now that we are living our pandemic lives, the drive-thru is really proving to be a very safe way for people to get their hands on some food, right? That seems to be working pretty well. But what I have to confess, I did not think deeper into the role that the drive-thru plays in our culture other than just that it's convenient. Right. I didn't think at all about that. And then I did a bit of research and reading, and I found this whole story that suggests that the drive-thru is, in fact, a symbol of American life. Right. And the words they used, I loved. They described the attitude that created the drive-thru as innovation obsessed, hyper efficient, stressed, and eternally pressed for time. And I had never stopped to consider that. I believe it's entirely true. I think it makes a lot of sense. And we really roll our eyes when we see a long snake of cars and we have to wait a long time in a drive-through. But I knew that there was a connection to car culture, obviously, but I had not considered the drive-through as a symbol of busy individualism, right? That I think is really fascinating. Tell me what you think.
I have a bit of a confession to make, and I didn't realize that this was weird, but it has been pointed out to me that this is really weird. I have never purchased food at a drive-through window.
You've managed to avoid it even on like a highwayed car trip?
On a car trip, I always get out so I can stretch
right.
my legs. I don't, it's just,
right.
I mean, unlike you, I didn't grow up in the suburbs, so there aren't that many drive-through opportunities around where I live, but I don't know. It's just not on my radar. And, you know, I mentioned it to a few people while prepping for this article, and they're all looking at me like I'm an alien. I didn't realize.
It's pretty amazing, actually, that you've never been through a drive-thru.
Unusual it is. Because I do own a car. I've had a car for years, so it's not the car that's the issue. But even if I think back to being in the car with my parents, I don't remember them ever taking us through. So I just wanted to start here. What's up with drive-thru? Like, when do people use drive-thrus and why?
Well, okay, so to this point, I love this because the reality is in the U.S. right now, I'm not sure what the Canadian number is, but 1 in 3 meals in the U.S. is eaten in a car. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And our numbers are not far away from that, right? The drive-thru is a very common place. And you can get anything to eat, right? The Starbucks drive-thru, I've seen their pharmacy drive-thrus, like, you know what I mean? That has really rolled beyond the food world. Yes.
And for the record, I have eaten in a car that I have done. Right. But it's either been like a packed something, or, you know, if I pop in on a road trip, for example, for a coffee and a snack, and there's some coffee left over, I'll bring that in the car with me sometimes. But
And the drive-thru's quick moves, lots of on the way to work.
That is a scary statistic.
Yeah. It's really, really something. And then, okay.
But I feel like that speaks to the place that food is taking in our lives. Like, I would not ever leave the house without having had food.
Yes.
So, but I realize, again, that's probably an anomaly.
I think you're right.
It's interesting to me that someone would be so rushed to, I guess the idea is you're so rushed to get out that you don't have time to prepare food, and then you get hungry on the way and you drive through.
And I think it's just the sheer hours we're clocking inside of our cars. Right? People who have set to at least a couple of hours a day in a commute, the stop through the drive-thru is just stage A on the journey. Right, that's just the way it goes, and they know, and the I've seen it. Right, the people behind the drive-thru, they recognize, they know that you're the double with the everything bagel toasted with cream cheese. They know, right? Because every morning it's the same thing that's happening. Drive-thru culture is really, really strong, particularly in the suburbs, because I think that there's a space issue. Obviously, drive-thrus take space, and in cities it becomes much more expensive. But what I thought was fascinating is I shared a piece with a Canadian perspective on drive-thrus, and it had never occurred to me that city planners would avoid drive-thrus because they're not neighborly. Right? And it makes perfect sense when you consider
there are
people in a car on the way out, right? On leaving the scenario. Nobody is staying and being invested. But I had never thought.
Yeah, it's not something I associate with a neighborhood.
Or a community, exactly.
It's certainly something I associate with being sort of in the middle of nowhere.
That's it.
There are a few drive-thrus in the city, though.
There are a few.
The other thing that I found interesting in that piece, because you shared it with me, is the fact that they say that the focus of these restaurants, I guess 70% of their service is the actual drive-through window as opposed to walk-ins. And so they've become super efficient with it. And the speed of the service at a drive-through is part of what persuades consumers to stay in the car rather than come in. And I was thinking about that, and I was wondering, I don't know, maybe you might have some insights for me. What is the incentive for the restaurant? Like, why is the restaurant trying to keep people in their cars and out of the restaurant? Because that's what they're saying by being faster with the drive-through.
Yeah. Totally.
I guess that's true. Because if people aren't sitting and chatting.
More sales per moment, right? Nobody has to stop and sit down and eat. All you have to do is get the thing and put it in somebody's hands. They're technically already sitting somewhere.
So hospitality, right, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, hilarious. But yes, that is entirely the truth. It feels like
it's
a bit of a grim.
Anti-Joshna.
It is, right? It is. It's a bit of a grim story. Yet, I have also had an experience through a drive-thru. I remember there's a burger joint on the way up to Creemore, right? And there's a burger joint on a corner, two competing burger joints. One of them has a drive-thru. I drove through and it was staffed exclusively by a very competent troop of teenagers who managed it all beautifully. And they made, and it was like, it's a family business, so it's not a sort of big chain of anything. And so patiently with the, what, all the things I want on my burger. And, you know, and they really walked me. And I was like, this was a delightful drive through. Like you, they were competent on it. Things moved quickly. And the food was delivered really nicely.
So then in those cases, are you generally eating in the car or will it sometimes be that you're grabbing it and you're going to bring it home?
Oh, no. At that point, I'm eating in the car. I'm eating in the car for sure.
You're eating while it's still warm.
Yes.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah, and it was fascinating.
Did you know that In-N-Out Burger is a popular American burger chain? One of the first they were one of the first to have a drive through or drive up as it was, you know, at that time. But these days you can tell them if you are planning to eat in the car, they will unwrap your burger and have the bottom still with the wrapper so that you can just grab the thing and take a bite. Right. You can ask for it like for the road or
save
whatever
on packaging.
It is, right. So that you don't have to do any unwrapping. You just grab it and eat. Come on. Americans are known for one thing. It's making things convenient.
Yeah. Certainly reading these articles and, you know, how it's all about efficiency and all that has made me very confused about why I haven't done it, because I'm all about efficiency.
That's amazing.
And I think it's just literally not on my radar. Josh, now I came across this article that I found fascinating.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk with you about it. The article is called Why a Variety's Taste Matters, Looking Beyond Just Yield and Stress Tolerance. Right. And this article was a very earnest article arguing that giving consumers what they like is an essential step in enhancing a variety's commercial success. And that this article recommended that people who are breeding crops go back to the farmers as an essential. Sorry, I'm just laughing because it's just so unbelievable that the breeders go back to the farmer as an essential part of incorporating end user feedback in a variety's breeding process. So it was just, the whole thing was just an example of how tone deaf some organizations can be in their approach to food.
Yes.
So long story short, there's this organization called the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center.
I love their title.
Based in Mexico.
I love the title.
And for more than 5 years now, they've been breeding different corn varieties in parts of Africa. Mm-hmm. And it's great. I mean, they're focusing on tolerance and increased yield. And their goal is to improve food security. Mm-hmm. So all that is fantastic. What is really weird to me is that it isn't till last fall that it occurred to them to start thinking about, well, what does this corn taste like? And is it pleasant to eat? And what is the texture like? That did not even, wasn't on their radar. And so this article was arguing that, you know, you should take the taste of the food into account when you're breeding it.
Isn't it nuts? Right? The whole story. I am familiar with this phenomenon. I've seen it before. This is, in fact, a real thing.
You are.
Definitely. Definitely. It has happened a lot. I've had a couple of contexts. One is I've just chatted with farmers and I ask about flavor from different versions or varieties or, you know, how they've understood it. And nobody ever has anything to tell me. No one is ever like, oh, I've never even tasted it. I've never even, right? And then there is an American chef. He's based in New York, named Dan Barber, who I am a major fan of. I run to keep up with Dan Barber. And he really wanted to breed. Squash is what he was focusing on. And he has a farmer who works with him on his beautiful sort of agricultural center that he has. And he was talking to this farmer about the things that they could do to maximize the flavor in this squash. Right. And one of the things was growing smaller.
Yeah.
So flavors are concentrated, that sort of thing. And the report that he heard from this farmer was that he had never before been asked to breed for flavor. Right.
So and Dan, weird.
Dan,
now that you mention it, I've been doing work with hop farmers here who for the first, I mean, they've had hop fields for a long time. And for the first time ever last year, they started thinking, boy, we should understand how these hops come through in the finished, in the beer.
It's amazing.
So weird.
It's so weird. And the thing that really screamed out to me when I read this and thought about this is that it's yet another piece of evidence of the, like, the imposition of business structure onto the food system, right? There was so much thought paid to what it would take to get that crop most densely and efficiently farmed and ready for market, right? That's what we thought about. But there was no thought about what happens, like, when you... will the market want this when you actually get there? Is this in fact what the market wants? Like, it's just extraordinary to be like,
yeah,
this is how to grow this thing, this is how to harvest this thing, these are the chemicals that we're going to add, and no one has thought about how does this stuff taste, which, to be honest, yeah, there's something relieving and encouraging about that, about the fact that nobody has ever thought about it, as opposed to they have thought about it and they were cool with these horribly empty, awful flavors, right? Because a lot of this food...
I don't know which is worse.
I don't know.
I don't know which is worse.
It's a good question. But I was like,
but it was interesting.
Didn't even think about it.
Yeah. Well, reading between the... Yeah, I don't think they did think about it.
I don't think so.
Because reading between the lines in the piece, they didn't explicitly state it. But what seemed to be happening is they were breeding these new varieties of corn and putting them out on the market. And farmers were gravitating towards old seeds that they had been using before. And it seemed to be mostly due to the flavor. Because the thing is, on these farms, they use a lot of corn. And they do use some of it for cattle feed and that sort of thing. But then they're also eating it. They're having it for breakfast. They're, you know,
it's a staple in the diet.
Integrating it into their diet. And then they're selling it at the market. So... Of course, if they're selling it to people as food, those people are going to buy the ones that taste best to them, right? With the best texture and aroma. So, I mean, I guess better late than never. It's great that they made this discovery last year and that they have started doing quite a bit of sensory testing, asking farmers and consumers to rate the flavor and the texture of these corns that they're breeding and that they're taking it into consideration. And, you know, good to whoever wrote this article for putting it out there.
It's
building a case.
Hilarious, revolutionary idea, right? There was another little piece in there in that article that I thought was fascinating. There was a quiet suggestion that even gender might have something to do with understanding desirability of a crop, right? They made some quiet reference to the fact that for the first time they asked women for their opinion. Women who do the lion's share of the world's agriculture and cooking, right? If then the big picture across the whole planet, women are sowing, you know, are working the land and they're cooking all the food in the kitchen. So like, oh, what if we ask the women what they think tastes good? Fantastic, right?
You know,
humanity is hilarious.
A revolutionary article all around.
So good. So good.
So on a practical note.
Yes.
Joshna, I came across this article on freezing food.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is useful information. Mm-hmm. And I guess the first thing that I wanted to ask you is freezing food part of chef training? Do they cover that in chef school?
Yes, definitely.
What to freeze,
definitely.
What not to freeze, how
the
to freeze it.
The use of the freezer, particularly because in most contexts we have a walk-in freezer, right? And so managing the inventory, it's very easy for things to get lost, but from a restaurant perspective, there's piles of money sitting in that inventory, right? So managing things that are frozen and freezing things properly so that they will last for the length that you're hoping are really important things that we learn. Like, we are definitely consciously taught how to freeze properly and to manage temperature shifts, you know, for safe handling and all of that. And so I love this.
So unlike the rest of us, you're not one of those people who sits there in front of the freezer thinking, can I put this in? Is it
going
to taste good on the other end? No, you don't have that moment.
I don't. And generally speaking, anything can be frozen. Right. Generally speaking, there's very few things that don't, like raw potatoes, dairy sometimes doesn't always you know, come through. But you can freeze
anything. Why would someone freeze? So the article did mention not to freeze potatoes, and that was baffling to me, because don't potatoes keep forever?
Not once you keep them
in a dark spot.
Yeah, exactly. Not once the skins have been cracked open and they, you know what I mean, and all, because if it's like a sliced potato or a diced raw potato, then all the areas have been exposed, and then they get all waterlogged.
Oh, I see.
You can keep that potato in a dry, cold root cellar somewhere, no problem. But once you cut it up and wrap it in plastic or whatever it is and then put it in a freezer, it's not a nice return at all.
So long story short, if you want to like pre-prepare fries, you have to blanch them or fry them
in the freezer. Just don't even think
okay,
about
got
that.
It.
And also that also waterlogged potato in the hot fry oil is nothing you want to have to deal with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
I will say.
I also found the talk of eggs.
Yeah. Oh,
really off-putting. Oh. I don't know who would, if they said don't freeze a boiled egg or an egg yolk. And I was trying to think of a circumstance where I might want to do that.
Freeze an egg? Yeah, I can't even think about it.
A boiled egg? Yeah.
Listen, even our friends at McDonald's are cracking fresh eggs into those Egg McMuffins every morning. Right? Even they are doing it. So don't even worry about freezing eggs. I will tell you that I think one of the best nuggets of wisdom in this whole piece is the tip about laying things flat to freeze and then packing them up. That is a key piece, particularly if you want to freeze things like berries or chopped fruits and vegetables or things like that. People's instinct will be to do the chopping or wash the berries and then just throw it in a Ziploc bag and shove it in the freezer. And all that's going to get you is one big ice block of whatever it is that you've put in there. But if you lay the berries out or lay the bits of broccoli on a sheet pan and put that in the freezer first, let them get frozen and then collect them all up and put them in a Ziploc bag or a container and then freeze them, they will serve you very, very well. Everybody listening, that is the way to freeze your food for sure.
For sure. Yeah, I like the idea of thinking about how you're going to use it on the other end and putting in it, making sure it's frozen into the portions that you're going to need.
Yes, that's the other thing.
Whether that be individual berries or,
totally,
you know, smaller containers, larger containers. The other thing I thought was really helpful just as a tip was to think about it as freezing things that you're going to want for flavor and not for texture.
Yes, yes. Very smart.
Because we have ginger. Our ginger is in the freezer.
Yep.
And for most of the applications that we use ginger for, that's fine. And it's actually a lot easier to grate ginger.
Because it submits
a
bit more once
it's
a bit wet, yes.
But yeah, I learned the hard way, you know, in an instance where I needed an actual piece of ginger in a recipe.
Ooh.
That if you slice off a piece of that frozen ginger and then it melts and it's just this glob.
Yeah, it's not.
You know, there's nothing, the texture is completely lost. So I liked that tidbit as well. I thought it was very useful to think about.
It was very useful. The thing that, and along the same lines as the ginger, I remembered my own mom and my aunties doing this thing, because Indian food, the basis of Indian food is pastes of garlic and ginger and chilies and and all of the things, generally speaking, that we'd have at the time when I was a kid, we'd have to go to a special store to find them all, right? It was this big effort. But they bruise, you know what I mean? And so to use them up and to maximize the use of them, my mom and my aunties would have this like every month, every 2 months or something. They would do a big grind up of garlic and ginger and green chilies, and then fill that into ice cube trays, right? And so they would pop them all out and put those ice cubes into a Ziploc bag, and one would come out to go into a pan with the onions. Right? Because everything just needed to be pureed and mixed into the base of the dish anyway. We didn't need to see any texture
or
anything.
Yeah, it's
right?
just flavor. Yeah.
And that was a very tidy, easy way, because freezing does do a really good job of maintaining the integrity of the flavor. Like, you really can unlock the freshness of something once you thaw it out, at least this way. And that was a super, super helpful tip, I think.
I've been honestly just rediscovering my freezer. Okay. My freezer was like a forgotten land before this time of isolation. And now that I'm doing my groceries every 2 weeks, a lot lives in the freezer.
Yes, of course.
And I had to develop a new relationship with it. So now I want to take it to the next level.
I love that.
And use it for my cooking.
Okay.
What can I do?
So
what are some hacks, dare I say?
I love it. Definitely in the pastry kitchen. Anytime pastry is being made, the freezer is your friend. And so when I make things like scones or pie crust, anything that needs flakiness, I always like to, after I finished sort of assembling the thing and my hot hands have gotten involved and perhaps warmed the butter up, right? I will have everything formed, brush the egg wash on the top, whatever has to be done. And then that tray will go into the freezer for about 20 minutes just so the butter firms up again, because that will give me maximum flakiness. And on my scones, it will give me the vertical that I'm looking for. I want those scones to grow up. And baking from frozen really maximizes the potential of that happening. So in the pastry kitchen, the freezer is your best friend. It really helps. Other things I like to do is that whenever you're working with chocolate, if I'm just dipping fruit in chocolate, you know, simple things.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to flash it quickly in the freezer than to let it spend half an hour in the fridge, because I find that the fridge, it can start getting a bit sweaty, the condensation, and you know what I mean? And it doesn't quite work. Whereas when you do that, just like 10 minutes in the freezer, boom, instant frozen. And you get the nice crunch on the outside of a strawberry without the strawberry having to thaw and get soggy. You know what I mean? It's just one quick hit. It works really
just long enough.
Sometimes you need the quickness of the instantaneousness of the freezing. It helps a ton. Freezer really works.
Thanks for that. Well, you know, I have taken up baking, so
I can't wait.
Looking forward to trying some of these techniques. I learned a new word this week, Joshna.
Tell me.
Visalgia.
Ooh. What is it? What
means
does it mean?
Hangover.
Oh.
And
that was a new
embarrassed
one for you. Come
yeah,
on.
I'm embarrassed that I didn't know it. Visalgia. I don't think it's a word I'm going to be using, but it's good to know.
Good to know. let's talk about hangovers.
Yeah. Do you have a hangover cure or preventative regime that you do?
When I did much more drinking than I do now, which was when I was in university, I did a solid amount of drinking. And the one thing that worked was advice from my pharmacist mother, who gave us effervescent vitamin C tablets.
Right.
And so the Redoxa, they're like in this funny little tube, and we would put two of these little like Alka-Seltzer-y kind of things in as much like as big a glass of water as we could take down. And before we went out drinking, we would chug one of those, and you would wake up like fresh and happy to greet the day the next day.
Oh, nice.
That was reliable. It was quite reliable. I remember that from my mega drinking days.
I think back in my university days, I was all about the huge greasy breakfast in the morning.
Greasy breakfast and a Gatorade did it.
Than
I
the
remember
prevention.
That. Yeah.
Big greasy breakfast. But now, well, you know, drinking is part of my job, and, normally I'm just sampling, but at events and stuff, it can get interesting. So yeah, for me, I just make sure that I've eaten well, that I'm hydrated, and then just don't drink too much. It is at the end of the day, what I have learned is the only true, in my mind, hangover cure. Just don't drink too much.
Yeah, it's the truth. Because the older you get, the more painful the hangovers are becoming. I'm learning that for sure.
I've had hangovers from just one drink. It is it's not acceptable.
The elasticity that once was is gone. Yes.
So people are obviously on a constant search for hangover cures. I think we still don't exactly know what causes hangovers, which is why the cure is so elusive. But there's a new study, and can you guess which country?
I'm going to guess this is the Brits. Right? Is
it close. The Brits, Germany.
Or the Americans? The Germany. Germany. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Another beer drinking nation, right? The University of Mainz. No, most of them are in England, but Germany's also doing its fair share of alcohol related studies. And what's really interesting about this study is it goes against the conventional wisdom. I think most people these days, and certainly from what you were describing that your mom was prescribing, link hangovers to dehydration due to the fact that we have to visit the bathroom often. And then an associated loss of vitamins and electrolytes and that sort of thing. And that, you know, you also mentioned Gatorade earlier. So this article, this study rather, what they did is they refocused their attention on plant extracts. So they used something called Barbados cherry, which I'm not familiar with. Are you?
No, me neither.
No. Prickly pear, yum, yum.
Yep.
Ginkgo biloba, willow, and ginger root. And so they took a large group of people, over 200 people, and they had them drink for 4 hours and then had them come in 12 hours later to report on their hangovers. And they split this group into three. One group was given vitamins and minerals. So this would be the group that's testing the theory that we were just discussing. Mm-hmm. Another group was given vitamin, minerals, and plants. So these prickly pear, ginkgo biloba, Barbados cherry, willow, and ginger root. And then a third group was just given a placebo.
Okay.
And interestingly, they found that the group that had the plant extracts had fewer hangover symptoms.
Nice.
Than both the placebo and the ones that were taking vitamins and minerals. So the ones who were, you know, technically replenishing their electrolytes and so on.
Oh, right, right. So there was more, right? That's interesting, huh?
It is. And this is what I found really fun in the piece. Did you get to the part with the different symptoms?
Yes, yes. I have a note. That was one of my favorite bits, totally. I loved that general indifference was listed as a symptom. It made me laugh.
I was wondering if you'd catch that.
I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was so funny. And I was like, yeah, I get that. Sure.
27% less feeling of indifference. I guess I never so really great. Associated that with a hangover. But
me neither. Not at all. It makes sense when you think about it. But I had never put that together. I thought that was super great.
And so they also reported 34% less headache, which, you know, we all associate headaches with hangovers, 42% less nausea, and then 41% less restlessness, which I also
Yeah, the restlessness was a curious one, too, because I actually find that moving is tricky.
Right.
When I am hungover, right? When I am hungover, having the will to sit up and take the Advil, I have to really, like, have a strong conversation with myself in my own head to lift my head up and do that, right? So the restlessness also didn't seem to quite fit.
Yeah, feeling restless and indifferent at the same time, it just feels like bad combination. It's a horrible place. If you're enjoying our podcast, please support us at patreon.com/hotplatepod. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Please consider leaving us a rating or review. It helps others find us. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hot Plate Pod. Follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Original music by Dave Bell. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. Thanks for listening.